For our first episode, we decided to go big or go home. We're talking to Mathieu Côté, head of partnerships at Behavior Interactive, who's letting us have a peek at what's going on behind the scenes of major IPs like Dead by Daylight. Hey guys! Hey guys, welcome to the first ever Behaviors Interactive new podcast called Crafting the Imaginary into Play. My name's Antoine Cailluette. I'm going to be your host for this new podcast. I hope you like my voice. And I'm with Fricot Dussault, who's the producer of the podcast and the mastermind behind all the recordings and all the planification, because I suck at it. And you're great at it, Fricot.
Yeah, that's what I've been told. Thank you, Antoine. I'm happy to be here, and I'm happy to present the podcast to all of you.
Yeah, because you must be wondering why we're having a podcast for, we're a video game studio. Why do you have a podcast? Don't you want to just do video games? Well, yeah, but we also want you to have a look inside what's happening in a video game studio.
Yes, we want to make the inaccessible accessible.
Oh, that's a nice one, Fricot. Yeah. Show the unshowable. That's what we want to do.
Oh, that one was better.
Oh. We want you to have an insider feel to what it is to
be behind the scenes of the video game industry, and particularly Behavior Interactive.
Yeah, that's a tough word, huh?
Particularly.
But yeah, that's the whole point of the podcast.
We're very excited about this podcast because you're going to meet some great people, developers that are working on games for years now,
and they want to share. Know otherwise.
Exactly, and they want to share some their expertise and what
insights
they're working on. So it's gonna be a great adventure. Oh, and just so you know, crafting the imaginary into play is our mission.
Yeah,
that's Behavior's mission.
Yeah, making great games is done by crafting the imaginary into play.
Exactly. So that's why we call the podcast like this.
Clever, right?
Very clever.
The first guest that we have on our podcast is the amazing Mathieu Côté, who's head of partnerships here at Behavior, and who's responsible for adding franchises to our IPs, mainly Dead by Daylight. You know about Pyramid Head. Do you know about Halloween? Do you know about Nicolas Cage, who we're going to talk about in the episode? Well, Mathieu is going to explain everything to you in depth.
And he has amazing stories to tell. He has a lot of experience. He's been at Behavior for almost 12 years now.
11.91 days. I made my research.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So it's so interesting. You need to listen to this podcast if you want to know more about Dead by Daylight, the story behind it, and how it is to work with licensees and to make new partnerships, to reach out to big stars like Nicolas Cage. You got to listen to this podcast.
So
let's go.
Let's go.
Let's do it.
Let's start that podcast. Let's start it. That's the sound of the fabulous sound of Matt Côté's voice that you're listening right now, and listen to his smooth voice.
Are we doing the ASMR version of the show?
That's a great idea. It's the first episode, so we're still figuring out the voice we want to have, but hey, ASMR is a good idea, man.
Okay, let's be quiet. It's nice. It's a pleasant Friday morning.
Exactly.
Yeah. Let's get going.
Yes, let's get going, man. We're excited to have you here today because you're a big name at Behavior, Matt. But I'll brag for you if you want.
Sure, if you want to, I'm not comfortable with it.
Just don't answer me. I'll talk to a wall if you want.
Go on.
Everyone who's listening right now, Mathieu Côté is a big name at Behavior. He's been here for almost 12 years, right?
Yeah.
Almost 12 years. He's been a major part of I guess I'll talk about Dead by Daylight, but you've been a big
help. I mean, I've done a few things before that.
Yeah. But we can talk about it if you want later.
Sure.
You're working with licenses and big, I don't know, maybe you're better to explain it to me, but you're talking with, I'll say, actors and licenses and how to add new licenses.
I talk with very few actors, okay. But I do talk to licensors. I talk to a lot of agents and lawyers and people who are responsible for managing catalogs often.
Okay.
Yeah, it's one of the most important parts of my job right now is it's funny because it took us a while to figure out what my title should be because I was doing so many weird things around Dead by Daylight. And it ended up being Head of Partnerships. It's been my title for a few years now, and it kind of fits because it's true.
You've got a head and you do partnerships?
That's about it, yeah. I try to make friends with as many people as I can. Mm-hmm. I try to make sure that when we start working together on collaborations, it ends up being fun for everyone and we come out of it with more success on both sides, right? That's sort of my mandate.
But before we go in, you know, en profondeur, like we say in French, like if we go like straight into it, I want people to know who you are. Where do you come from? What's your background? Where are you born, Matt?
I was born in Sainte-Foy, and next to Quebec City.
Yeah.
I stayed there until I was a year and a half. I grew up, most of my youth was spent in Chicoutimi, which is about, 7-hour drive north of Montreal, more or less.
Yeah.
I spent a few years in Paris when I was a kid because my dad had to work there. And then when I was 12, 13, I moved to Montreal and I hated it.
Oh, yeah? Even after living in
Paris? Can we swear on
Paris?
This?
Yeah. I mean, we can bleep it. Okay. Yeah, exactly.
All right.
We'll figure it out afterwards.
I really hated it, is what I wanted to say.
Yeah, really, yeah.
It took me a couple of years to really understand what's fun about big cities and big towns.
So did you hate Paris also? Or was it a big city?
No, I was too young to really realize it. So it was a small thing. But at like 12, 13, I was starting to try to make sort of my own friends and my own life. And coming to Montreal was a rude awakening, let's say.
Oh, yeah?
my father signed me up at Saint-Luc School, which is a very, very intensely diverse school, which was a weird thing for a small kid from Chicoutimi.
Yeah.
It's like 65 religions, 118 different nationalities. I was in the Français Fort, which is like a strong French, I guess.
Advanced French.
And there were three.
Coming from France.
But there were three of us in the class that French was our
first language. Oh my God.
The rest were like secondary language.
Yeah.
And so it was really intense, and there was a lot of gangs, lots of fighting. Police were around the school every night. Like the ambulance would come once a week. Like it was an intense thing. So I was very punk at the time. I was doing a classical ballet.
Oh,
I had like Liberty Spikes.
Yeah.
And I actually found a crew of like five other misfits that didn't fit anywhere, and we started playing RPGs.
It's fun
to find Dungeons and Dragons, Shadowrun, all the like World of Darkness, whatever, and we played role playing games all the time.
So I guess it's kind of your the introduction to video game, if you want. It's kind of not a video game, but it's
kind of weird because I always played video game. I had a Commodore 64 very, very early on. I had a Super Nintendo, and then first career, if you will, when I came out of school, I took some classes to become a bartender. So I was a bartender for a few years.
Doing flair and stuff like
that? Actually, I was in shitty, shitty, poor bars. And one of the funnest ones.
You like juggling more than bartending. Is that it?
I do juggle, but I don't like juggling with things that can break.
Yeah,
but I worked in a bar called the Vampire Lounge, and I was a bartender there. And most of the time, I was working in character. It was LARPing for the Vampire the Masquerade and all of these things. It was super weird. There's still
here in Montreal.
Yeah. There's still legends of this. It was right next to the Loft on Saint Laurent Street.
I've never heard about those.
Well, they're. Yeah. Anyway, I talked to Stéphanie Marchand, who's on the studio side. She used to hang out there.
Really?
We had a fake like an electric chair on a 9-volt battery, just enough to just.
Anyway. So I guess your biggest night was Halloween, I guess.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And so I worked there for a bit, and then I went back to school to become a teacher, either high school French or English. I wasn't sure, but I was studying languages and pedagogy, and I was supposed to be a teacher.
Yeah.
Then life happened, and I ended up going back to work, and I essentially worked as a manager in a sex shop for like 5 years.
Was it gory teens, or it's?
I continued to be a distributor of vice. Essentially, like there was a trend.
Pretty much.
And then I quit that job because they were the cheapest, crappiest employers you could get. And then I was at a sort of unemployment sort of program that said, you know, you have to talk to this person to continue to get unemployment. And then this woman said, oh, by the way, you keep talking about video games. Maybe you should work in video games. And I'm like, ha, you silly goose. People don't work in video games. They play video games, right? You can't. She's like, no, it's actually a big business in Montreal. It's starting to become a thing.
Yeah.
And that was
22
years ago or something.
Okay. Yeah.
So I took a big gamble, borrowed a lot of money from the bank to pay for these classes, and I got hired immediately out of school. By actually 2 weeks before I got my diploma, I was hired by EA that was just opening a studio in Montreal.
Yeah,
I was employee number 99, I think, at the time. Like it was really early.
Top 100. Good.
That's great. And I started as an animator there.
Oh.
And I was an animator for about 6 months.
Okay.
Like I was a okay animator.
Yeah.
But I knew I was never going to be the guy that gets the call from like DreamWorks or Rockstar saying, we want you for our next project.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I knew the guy. He was with me in school and he was great. But and he's at Rockstar San Diego right now. He's awesome.
Really?
But I was like a decent animator, but I had a big mouth. I was pretty good at getting people rallied and social chemistry and getting stuff
you're
to happen.
A glue guy.
Kind of the glue guy. And so I turned into the producer line really early on. And I did that for a couple of years at EA until...
Was it hard to make the transition, like, inside the business? Was there a lot of...
No, I was lucky enough that I was with some people that gave me a chance. And that's something that I think, like... Everybody in the industry, but actually everybody in any industry, at some point, someone gives you a chance. Mm-hmm. Someone believes you can do a job even though you've never done it and gives you an opportunity to prove yourself. And I think it's really important to be that person for other people when you have an opportunity to do so down the line.
Is that what happened with Behavior? Is that did they give you a chance?
I was sort of very unhappy at EA at the time. It was between projects. I didn't know what to do. And then I called some of my friends who had moved on from EA, namely Chris Ferreira and Matt Jackson, who's not here anymore. But they both said, I'll come to Behavior. You'll be super happy here.
Yeah.
And I got an interview, and I was that was sort of
as a producer.
An associate producer at the time. But I got interviewed by two women. It was almost a test. It was Stephanie Marchand and Stephanie Marshall. And I'm like,
the French and English version.
You is this a test? Like, anyway, they both were interviewing me to know if they wanted to hire me to work for them, which was great. And I'm like, okay, this is sort of refreshing. And so I got hired to do some work for hire. So Behavior was doing mostly work for hire at the time. That was like 99% of the business. I worked on a couple of different projects, which were really fun. As a producer, it was one of the most educational thing you can do, which is small projects, one after another, 6-month project, a year max, which means you can see the production cycle from start to finish.
Yeah,
again and again.
Lion's Den, like all of a sudden, like in the big project.
No, but the thing is, when you work on a super big project that takes 5 years, you only see one cycle in 5 years, right?
Oh, yeah.
And there's so many things that pop up again and again, but if you don't see them 4, 5, 6, 7 times, it's really hard to anticipate the problems that are going to happen and be ready to mitigate whatever risks pop up. So it was great for me. It was super educational to be able to get a sort of fast forward of so many different projects with so many different challenges, mostly working with licensors. So learning how to take someone else's IP and create something new with it that still respects the source material.
Okay.
Very educational, super fun. And then I was put on Naughty Bear.
Okay.
So Naughty Bear is one of Behaviour's own IPs. It's one of the rare ones. Every few years, we would try to do our own stuff. We did that one with a publisher, 505. And I worked on Naughty Bear Panic in Paradise, which was the latest one that we've done. And it was awesome. We had so much fun doing that. It was really silly. It was a fun game.
Yeah.
The team was awesome. And the game did okay. The problem is, like, if you want to play it again today, which I absolutely recommend you do, you have to find an Xbox 360 that has it on already, because it was only available on like Xbox Arcade.
Oh yeah.
Which nobody has access to today.
I've heard that it's kind of a Conquer Bad Fur Day. Have you ever played that?
Maybe in terms of tone.
Yeah, the
and
tone,
humor.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
Because essentially Naughty Bear is sort of set in the world of the Care Bears.
Okay.
Sort of. But it's not the real world of Care Bears, but it's like the world of Care Bears. Everybody's happy. Everybody's called Sunshine and Happy and Tiddles.
Yeah.
And then one of them is called Naughty, and he doesn't get invited to parties because he's naughty. And then he decides to kill them all.
Oh, yeah. Well.
And so that was sort of a, like, you can do horrible, terrible things. You can put people into the wood chipper in front of their parents, but it's fluff coming out.
Yeah.
So it's okay, right?
Yeah.
They're only
it's
teddy
not too
bears.
Rough, it's even though
people.
It's kind of a hardcore.
So it was super silly, and we really could go really far in the stupid humor and the really deep, like, depravity, because it's just bears. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
We did get an 18 plus rating in Japan for sexual content, which we have never figured out.
Really?
Like, there's something in there that someone thought was very arousing, and we got a rating in there.
It wasn't blurred.
We
That's
also
why.
Got a
Japan.
Well, it was public peeing, so I don't know if that's it.
Well,
and then we got a rating. We actually got denied in North Korea, which is not super surprising,
but it was
beautiful because it was for threatening the social fabric of society, which I thought this is a back-of-the-box quote if I've ever seen one. And so we made that game, and I made a couple of other games after that. And then one sunny afternoon, it might have been raining, my boss at the time, Eve, actually put me in, and he invited Ash Pennell, we were a dynamic duo. Like, I made all my games with him. Great creative director. The voice of Naughty Bear.
Okay.
And then Eve said, there's a new project that we want to do. It's got a really cool little prototype you can play already. Some designer made it. And then Ash is going to make it. He's got a vision for it. Your job is to make it a reality. And so I'm like, okay. And so we built a team. Essentially, we did like the Blues Brothers things, right?
Yeah.
We put the band back together.
Yeah.
We went to get Dave Richard, who was designer on Naughty Bear. Now he's the creative director on Dead by Daylight. We went to get Phil Ivanovich, who was the art director, now art director on Dead by Daylight, now moved on to some other project, but still very close to our heart. And a couple of other people who were like part of the original Naughty Bear team. Because it is the sort of spiritual grandfather to Dead by Daylight.
Yeah.
It was the comedy version.
The gory kind of
It's at its core, it's the fantasy of being the villain in a horror movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that has not strayed. This is what we did in a much more serious manner in Dead by Daylight.
But you can still feel the humor. There's
so many stupid things, especially. But like at the beginning of the project, nobody was looking too closely at what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
So we were able to get away with so many stupid things.
Yeah.
So a lot of the humor and a lot of the silliness and actually most of the lore got put in through the flavor text in the offerings, in the add-ons, in the items, because that's the only place where we had text mostly in the game. Like, there's no dialogues.
There were
almost no backstory to the characters. It was very minimal. So we had to put our stupid stuff somewhere.
And it's what resonates with the community now.
Yeah.
People love that.
Horror and comedy have always sort of been the two sides of the same coin, right?
Yeah.
Comedy is oftentimes described, at least in I've heard it described in psychology terms as, you know, you're terrified, but in a safe space. Yeah. Like there's something that comes and surprises you, but instead of being terrified, you're safe. Therefore, the yeah. release of the laughter happens.
Comes from the same place, pretty
That's
much.
It. Yeah, yeah. And so yeah, we have a lot of silly in our game.
So that was the start of Dead by Daylight. And you had experience before, like you said, starting out as a producer, talking to lawyers and franchises and stuff like that. Like,
yeah, as a producer in Work for Hire at Behavior, I was responsible for the relationship between us, the developer, and the licensor, who was essentially the client. So they said, we need a new game for SpongeBob. And then we go, okay, we'll make a SpongeBob game. And my job was to make sure the relationship stayed correct, make sure to sell our ideas well to the licensor or to the client so that they are happy with whatever we produce, and at the same time be their voice for the team, right?
Did you know from the get-go that you wanted to put franchises into Dead by Daylight, or you had like a base model and then you knew
To be fair, when we were about to ship Dead by Daylight, plan A, which like what we were about to do, was ram down the team and move on to another project, because that was the recipe at Behavior. Yeah. You make a project, then you ship it, then you move on to another project and you do another thing. Mm-hmm. So we did some professional projections. Like we hired a group to say, how many copies of this game do you think will be sold? Yeah. And they said 300,000 to 400,000 copies lifetime. and for us, we're like, yeah, okay, break even.
Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah.
Like, we didn't lose any money. We made a game that was fun. Let's move on with our lives. Mm-hmm. And so that was the plan, right? But when we built it, we knew that there would be an easy way to add more content, right? It's a game that was based on not being exactly sure what to expect. What are you going to be facing? Who the other players are? Where are we going? Therefore, adding more content would add to this unexpected result. The more there is in Dead by Daylight, the less you can know for sure what you're going to be facing, where you're going to be facing, etc. So for us, it was sort of an easy thing to add more content.
Yeah.
Now, adding licenses, I think we had discussed it a little bit, but it was kind of understood to be a pipe dream. And so obviously that's not how the story panned out, right?
No, not exactly, no. Because it's not a very local fan base.
Certainly not anymore. But even the first month of release of Dead by Daylight, like I think the million copy sold was in the first month. Like, it happened really, really fast.
How was the reaction? Were you, because you were waiting, you thought it was going to be like 300,000, you said, around that number?
Yeah, but lifetime.
Lifetime.
This was supposed to be like over a year or two, right?
Yeah.
And so when it kicked off and we realized how big it could become, we were lucky enough that like Rémi was on board, everybody was on board. They're just like, okay, let's just
get back to work.
Yeah, that's it. Like, you need more people, let's do this.
Yeah.
Literally.
And how many employees were there back then?
We shipped the game with about 30 people, maybe just a bit more, like closer to 40, in the weeks leading up, because we had a lot more QA.
Yeah.
But it's about 30 people that shipped Dead by Daylight.
I guess after selling a million copies, you're like, okay, we're going to
need a few more.
Yeah, a bit
but the
more
thing also
30.
Is like, we hired the first brand person, which was going to be brand marketing and everything else, 2 weeks before launch.
Oh, yeah.
Welcome. Before that, it was me and Ash and Dave doing like little dev diaries, which was super fun, but we didn't have community managers. I would go in people's Twitch stream and go, hey, I'm the producer on the game. I'm happy that you're playing. Here's some keys.
Yeah.
Like, that was it, right? And then we had to grow those teams. Same with Player Insight, which is the group now known as Player Insight.
Yep.
While we were developing, there was a dude that came by, Julien. He's like, oh, hey, I'm Julien. I'm in university. I study biology and specifically behaviors of populations, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to study the behavior of your...
Behavior.
Your groups. No, but your groups of players. Because it's easy to gather data from people who play games. Can I sit in a corner with my laptop there and just do my university studies on your... And we're like, sure, as long as you can maybe draw a couple of interesting analysis
that
you... Today, there's, 50 people in the Player Insight group. Julien is still there.
Yeah.
But now we have professional people looking at data, doing analysis, doing projections.
Yeah.
it's really interesting to see all this. Even the marketing team is now gigantic. We have a full-on marketing team and publishing effort. Same with player experience.
Yeah.
Used to be just me. Then we went to hire Gab Murphy, not Queen. She was a streamer of Dead by Daylight. Uh-huh. And we realized she was in Montreal. I'm like, oh, you're kind of positive and constructive when you do your stream. You know, you get a lot of people.
The early days of influencers.
And a little bit. We just got her on the phone. We're like, hey, well, actually, I got in her stream and said, hey, you're awesome. Can you come to the office? We would like to talk. And she's like, sure, I'll come by. And she came by the office. We offered her a job. She said yes. And that was the beginning of our player experience group that is now, what, 40 people, I think, around the world. Because that's the other thing, right? That's like you mentioned, it is a game that picked up a lot of fans around the world because, I mean, it's hard to say exactly why, but like, first of all, like we said, there's no voice lines. Like, so it's don't need to translate. Like it's people screaming and
yeah, sometimes like the most popular people on TikToks are doing TikToks without any words. And they're popular because everyone can understand.
Mr. Bean.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. That's the best example. No, but yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's universal and it's easily understood. And the thing is, horror is sort of universal themes also. And the game at its core, it's hide and seek. Every kid has played hide and seek at some point, right? Yeah. You need nothing to play.
Did you guys thought about that when you conceived the game? Or it's
not in that. It's not like we said, okay, what's the most universal experience we can go for? Like, it was not
It's like so many
we just had a prototype that we like, this is fun. Like, we call it, like in prototyping terms, I think it's scientifically, it's called thumb candy.
Okay.
Like literally, you grab the controller, you're playing a prototype, and you go, I don't know why, but this is fun. Like, I want to continue to press the buttons. And so there was a lot of luck involved in that too, right?
And I can't help but think about, like, everything got so big and bigger than we thought. And now you were putting licenses and, because, you know, you had to figure out a new way to make it exciting, I guess. Is that how you thought about it?
Well, the first DLC we did was called The Last Breath. It was a brand new killer, the nurse, and a brand new survivor with Nia. And we're like, okay, this formula is going to work. Like, we can add new content. We could add new stuff. We could add original stuff that's going to be interesting for a long time. And then the thing is, because we've been doing this job at Behavior for the last 30 years, making games with other people, we had a lot of contacts in the industry. And we also had a lot of contacts in licenses and in Hollywood to a certain extent. Like Disney, we know Disney. We've worked with
Humble
them quite a lot.
Yeah.
But it's true. Like Warner are people, like a lot of the big names in licensing, we know them because we've worked with them and we've already established a relationship of respect. And so I was able to get a hold of the company that's in charge of the catalog that contains Halloween, the original movie, 1984. And it was a conscious choice, that one. Like, really, we wanted to get to the most original one we could. We wanted the original version of what we thought was one of the most iconic legends of horror, right? Michael Myers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Even if you don't know his name, you know who it is. The
even
white
just
mask
the music, right?
Yeah.
Like all of it is very legendary. So we were lucky to be able to get that. They sort of took a chance on us. And then after that, it sort of snowballed, right? Because we had one, and then we can go and get on the phone and say, hey, by the way, you have Leatherface.
Yeah.
Would you like to join Michael Myers in the horror game that we have?
Yeah, yeah.
And those conversations started to become easier and easier as we moved along. Because at some point, let's say 3 years ago, I remember starting to talk to people going, do you want your spot in the museum of horror that is being established as Dead by Daylight, right? And going, Ash Williams from Evil Dead needs to be in a museum of horror. If you have a Hall of Fame of all the most legendary, iconic people
in
horror, you need that guy, right?
Yeah.
And it became easier to sort of sell it to people. And then people started to approach us also. It happened in a few occasions where people are like, hey, I see you're missing this person in your lineup. I think it's time.
Yeah.
And we go, yeah, it is.
Yeah.
And sometimes we'd say no. Like, there's a couple that we turned down.
Yeah, how do you know which
not
one?
Not many.
Which one are going to work out or which one are going to be a hit or something? Is it a hit and miss or you're just...
There's a list, right? There was a list for the longest time. Like, what's the top 10 licenses in horror?
Yeah,
and I think that you ask 100 people And the top 10 is going to be pretty much the same across the board. There's a couple of things. Like people will say Leprechaun needs to be there. And then you go, yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
And some of them also are forever going to elude us, I think.
Alien was a home run, right? It's like a huge franchise. And you've been working for, like I said at the beginning, almost 12 years now at Behavior and many years on Dead by Daylight. Is there one partnership that stands out to you? Like, oh my God, I'm so freaking proud to have that one.
No. I mean, they're all cool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's always hard work, I guess, and you're always happy to...
Like I was saying, Halloween was amazing because it was the first one ever that we did.
Yeah.
And it was a big one.
And it opens up a door.
Yeah, it was great. And the licensor was really, really awesome to work with. Still is today. I'm happy whenever I go meet Rand. And then there are other that are super special. Ash Williams, it was the first time we were using the actual actor. Obviously, you can't do Ash Williams without having Bruce Campbell.
Yeah.
And so Bruce Campbell even recorded some voice lines. It was the first time we had voice lines in the game. He did a little promo video, which was super funny. He was great to work with. You know, there's a couple of really interesting ones. Ghostface was super interesting because it was sort of adding to the canon of that universe, right? And the important thing for us was to not... infringe on the movie. So for instance, he's not talking on the phone like he does in the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
He does things.
What's up?
Well, no, that's a different movie. But that's it. So it was important to always keep those two IPs very, very separate, right?
Yeah.
It's the Ghostface mask and the character that we created. And now Fun World, who's essentially a merchant of costumes, right? That's their business.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now they sell the costume for the Ghostface character that we created.
Really?
Based on the Dead by Daylight IP in the Halloween stores, right?
That's crazy.
So it's sort of all... That was a super interesting one to navigate for that. And Nick Cage.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about Nick Cage, man. I'm excited about Nick Cage. He's such a huge name. It's like he's more than horror, too. He's like in comedy, he's like in dramas.
He's in everything.
Yeah, he's a huge meme. He's huge on the internet. It's like,
but at the same time, he does not have a personal media presence. Like, he's not on Twitter. He's not on Instagram. He's not on Facebook. He's not on anything. Like, he does not partake in that side of society.
Yeah.
He's a huge meme. He's present everywhere.
Yeah.
But not by himself.
Yeah, yeah.
He does the red carpet things and talk shows minimally. He does it because he promotes his material, because he's a consummate professional. He's one of the greatest actors out there.
Yeah.
But he does not play the social game, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so it came from an idea we had internally. We're like, oh my God, we need to have like... I think actually the idea of having a real person in the game rather than a character was something that we kicked around a little bit a few years back. And actually the first person we reached out to was Tony Hawk.
Oh, yeah?
And like that's a bucket list check mark for me.
Did
like,
you play when you were younger?
Of course I did.
Man, I have great memories from that game.
Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 1 is the best soundtrack to this.
Goldfinger.
Like, Baldur's Gate. I'm playing Baldur's Gate right now.
Oh,
The music is just mind-blowingly good.
Mm-hmm.
But the soundtrack from Tony Hawk Pro Skater 1 is
amazing,
still...
amazing, right?
Anyway, all that to say, Tony Hawk... very pleasantly and respectfully declined because he couldn't. And then we're like, okay, so we need another person who's a real person and who would... Because the thing is, the amazing thing with the world we've created in Dead by Daylight is that anybody could potentially be whisked away into the world of the entity, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't even matter if you come from a fictional world because of the whole sort of multiverse aspect of things. You could be from a different timeline. You could be from a different universe.
Mm-hmm.
The Michael Myers we got in the game is not from our world where Michael Myers is a character. He's from whatever world exists where Michael Myers is real, and artists here have sort of had glimpses of that universe, and that's how they created him here. That's sort of the story we created. And so... Nicolas Cage comes from our world or a very similar place where he got hired to do a movie somewhere that was weird. He got on set. He had a weird script that was very occult, and he did it with such gusto. And he's such an amazing actor that it broke reality, and it brought the entity to him, and he got whisked away to the fog, right? Which is a perfect storyline for him. In this case, I mean, we reached out. It's one of those cases where you're like, you know what? Once in a while, we do that. We have a crazy idea.
Kind of
we
a cold call.
Talk to our biz dev people. Like, we have a couple of people. We have a couple of agents, and we just sort of,
you know
it's
Hollywood.
The shotgun approach.
You said it.
No, you just go, try. Yeah. Just try to reach out, please. Mm-hmm. And then someone came back and said, okay, well, I can get you a phone call with the person who represents him.
I'm
like, all right. And then we sort of presented the idea, and the response we got was, like he said on stage at the Summer Game Fest, like, someone very close to me plays Dead by Daylight. I'm aware of your game. I know it. I think it could be cool.
Yeah.
And so it was a long conversation after that where, you know, we need to figure out exactly what the shape of that deal should be and what the boundaries also of the character creation that we're doing have to be, so that, you know, what is available, what is not. Like, can we do outfits loosely based on some existing characters that he's done and things like that? Like, no, stick to the stuff he wore in his personal life. And then we look and we go, wow, that's even more amazing. Like, what he wears when he gets out of the house, that man dresses for success, right? And it was super important to him, too. And it was great.
Is he the one, because you can play with Nick Cage as a survivor in the game, right? Is he the one who chose to be a survivor? Or you didn't
want
to kill anyone?
No, that's what we proposed to him. The idea of having him be a killer was never there, because our killers are supernatural.
Okay, yeah.
All of them, even the ones like the clown, let's say he's just a very mean guy.
Yeah.
But there's still something supernatural. Like the bottles that he throws have effects and things. And there's something other than human in most of our killers. Also, they're evil. Mm-hmm. And we wanted Nick Cage, real Nick Cage, in the game.
The
therefore,
one that everyone
he's
loves.
Not evil.
No.
He's a weird guy. He's a wonderful weirdo, and I love him to death. He's bigger than life, right? Mm-hmm. But he's not a bad guy, I mean, by any definition. So for us, it was important that he's a survivor, he's in there, and also that his voice is heard, right? Because he's got such a delivery that is unique to him.
Yeah.
We had a recording session, and we're in the recording studio where most of the voices of Dead by Daylight have been recorded. It's sort of.
Are you telling me that Nick Cage came here?
No.
Oh, my God. Gave me butterflies.
But the thing is, usually when we record voices, it's mostly screams and like grunts, and it's really, really rough on people's throats, right?
Yeah, yeah.
We hire a lot of like metal singers and people who are used to getting those screams out and
pig squeals.
Yeah, because it hurts, it's tough, and it usually takes 3 to 4 hours just to record those grunts, at the minimum. And so when we got Nick Cage, we're like, okay, we need you to record some voice lines for the promo video, for some of the backstory, for a lot of stuff. We'll need a lot of voice lines in the game, things like that. That's probably like 3-4 hours already. And we don't want to force you to do all the grunts and exertions, because they're just going to screw up your voice, and you're an actor. It's like scrapping your face.
And you can use some other people's
grunts. And his immediate response was, no, there's never been a Nick Cage sound alike, and we're not going to start today. I'm like, yes, sir. Of course, sir.
Yeah.
You know, in this case, you're like, yeah,
I'm
going to
squeal for you guys.
And so we had set up 2 recording sessions of about 3-4 hours just to make sure we could get all of that together. He came in. It was all set in Vegas, the recording session. We were there remote by video through a voice director that was there, super talented guy who would be there to get the information. And he came in, took his jacket off, took a sip of water, got started within 30 seconds. It was pure gold. Like every sound coming out of that man's mouth was pure gold.
Sometimes you get used to the fact that they're
He
great.
Did all the voice lines, all the in-game stuff, all the grunts, all the screams, all the screeches of pain in 3 hours. All of it was perfect. Like, thank you very much. Then we had a 5-minute chat to say just how thankful we were. And he left. And it was perfect.
Yeah, he's not a mega star for nothing. He's
that
good.
That man works hard, and he's good at what he does.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's what you get in the game, right? So many, and it's almost sad, but there is gold on the cutting room floor, right?
Mm-hmm.
He recorded some stuff at some point, and we're like, geez, we'll never be able to put that in the game, but it's so good. It's so good.
Like what? What couldn't you keep?
Like we'd give him lines and then we'd say, do a couple just after that. Just improv, like whatever.
Yeah.
And just him screaming about the crows. Oh, he's got a pet crow. I don't know if you know that about him. He's got a pet crow at home.
I don't know why I'm surprised, but yeah.
He's got a pet crow.
Okay.
And so when we, like, he knew that there were crows in Dead by Daylight, and we're like, okay, at some point you scare the crows and they alert the killer. And he went on this whole rant about the crows betraying him. He's been friends with them for ages. And like, it was amazing. It was great. And things about... I don't know if we have that in the game, but there was a beautiful moment when he's just screaming. Like, we're like, okay, there's a killer behind you. He just hit you. Now you're running away. Just before he gets you, what are you going to say? He's like, you can't kill me. I'm Nick fucking Cage.
I've got other questions that I... Well,
sure.
One question. Because I've heard that you've got somewhat of a following outside the country. In another country that's pretty far away.
But I haven't checked lately.
Okay.
But I assume... Well, it's not true.
I know the legend.
We had some friends from Japan come by last year. Actually, this year, a couple of months ago, they came by. It was awesome. Some great streamers from Japan. And yeah, I feel like I still have friends over there.
Yeah? Yeah, because I've heard that you had like... kind of a little following in Japan, and it was kind
we
of
went
a,
to the
you,
Tokyo Game Show, and it was kind of impressive. Well, I mean, obviously, I think I'm more easily recognizable over there because I don't look like the average crowd. But it was impressive, and I got told to please not walk the floors too much because it might create some traffic jams.
That's crazy.
But the funniest thing for me was that I was there with Marie-Claude Bernard, who's our head of PR and comms here.
Yeah.
And you don't get in her way. You just don't. This is not a bad idea for your health or your career or for anything else. And she's awesome. Like, I love traveling with her. But yeah, she was very good at making sure that I got to where I was supposed to go.
How did it came about? It was because of you
streaming?
I don't streaming,
know.
Or
no, I think it's because... Dead by Daylight is much bigger than we think in Japan. Uh-huh. At least it was surprisingly big for us there. And in Japan, there is this culture of... Culturally, there is an enthusiasm for passion. Mm. Like here, we have stories of like nerds getting picked on for liking things. In Japan, at least in my limited perception of the Japanese culture, I see a genuine... enthusiasm for people to love stuff. Like mm-hmm. if you're a fan of a thing, that's something to be proud of.
Yeah.
And give yourself to it and let your freak flag fly, right?
Yeah.
It's like, you love Pokemon? Yes.
Yeah.
Make a full outfit out of it.
Yeah.
And go in the streets and be proud of it, and you'll find other people who are fans of it, and people are gonna cheer you on, right?
Yeah.
And so if Dead by Daylight became big over there, the content creators over there sort of became big because of that, or were already big and just took it on, and there's a passion for it. And I think also the fact that we were very present, we were very transparent, we were very open and eager to get in a communication with them mm-hmm. and just interact. We have local community managers, like we hired people in Japan to represent us and to help us to be the voice of the community to us, right? Mm-hmm. In a place that we didn't understand as well. And so when I went there, I was like just, hey, hi, people, happy, I'm representing DBD. And then people got super excited. And because I've been sort of the face and the voice of the game for so long, like people were used to see me on the dev stream, they were used to seeing me on the anniversary broadcast and all these things. And therefore, yeah, there was a bit of a sort of celebrity thing where people are like, oh my God, it's the guy with the face that I saw in the thing, right? And so it got super exciting and it was sort of overwhelming. Like when we were at the Tokyo Game Show, I was on stage at the Twitch stage, which is a big thing.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, thousands of people pressed together at the front. And I keep the picture closed. Like I sat down and I talked and then people were translating and it was sort of all overwhelming.
They're all excited.
In the first row, there's a guy and I sort of get hypnotized because the guy has a shirt with my face on it.
Oh, my God. He raises it, and then your face is tattooed on
no,
his chest. Oh,
no,
that
okay. did not happen.
Oh, okay, okay.
But
that's crazy, yeah.
But that was kind of insane, right?
Did you meet him? Did you?
Yeah, I went to chat afterwards, yeah. and I couldn't chat with him because he's Japanese and I don't speak Japanese. But but it was fun. I took a few pictures, and everybody was happy. It was awesome. Then I told my mom, and she's like my mother, she's not exactly sure what I do for a living still, but she's very proud of me. Doesn't matter.
Are you planning to go back in Japan in some
I would love to.
Future,
I would love to have an opportunity to go back. I mean, obviously, since the pandemic, we've drastically reduced the number of shows we take part of. Even the media tours, we tend to do that virtually now, which... Yeah. To be absolutely honest, is a better format.
Okay.
Like, it's just, we can have everybody together. It's easier to make sure that we have perfect sound, we have clarity, that everybody's present. We can show clips, we can show things, as opposed to when you meet people in a hotel room or in a hotel lobby and you have a laptop to show them the video beforehand. And it's like, it's just better.
Yeah,
which I shouldn't say because I want Behavior to send me back to Japan to do some stuff, but...
What's the future for you here at Behavior Now? What are you doing? What are you working on now?
Right now, my job is sort of split in two. There's a big part of it that's still the licenses for Dead by Daylight, the existing one and the next ones, obviously. I spend a lot of my time on that.
Yeah.
And then the
so
other part...
So you know what's coming. You can't tell us, but
I can
you?
Never... Like, it's most frustrating part of my job is that... Today and yesterday, I'm working on amazing stuff that I will not be able to talk to anybody about for the next year, at least.
We won't tell anyone.
Because we work on the next year and the year after that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's frustrating. But let's say at the anniversary, we promised two licenses, I think with a capital L is how Stefan put it.
Oh.
And so we've released Alien, which was pretty big. I think we can agree.
Yes.
And that means there's... another one coming that we are super excited about. And I cannot wait to start talking to people about it and go, yeah, I told you we'd do it. But I can't say that right now.
Okay, well, maybe off mic I'll know afterwards. I don't know, but anyway.
The other part of my job right now is on the publishing efforts.
Yeah.
Islands of Insight is the very, very first game from that publishing arm that we have internally at Behavior where we go out there, we do some prospecting, we meet. I do a lot of, like, I call it business speed dating. Like, I sit there and there are people coming every 20 minutes to pitch me a project, pitch me a company, pitch me a new idea.
Yeah.
And then we get 1 out of 100 that we think is worth it, that we think fits within what we want to build, right? And so what we offer as a company is obviously some financing, but more importantly, publishing, marketing, data analysis, like all the stuff that we said earlier, like we built around Dead by Daylight. We now have that expertise. We now have those full teams working on it. And so we can help with a project like Islands of Insights, where this is a small company that's in Toronto. Actually, when we met the people from that company, I think there were 3 people. Now there are about 30. And they wanted to build a game. They had a great idea. And we said, you know what? Yeah. Okay, we'll help you build that game, and then we'll publish it, and we'll tell the world that you've made a great game. So this is the very first time. Just before this, I was sitting in the meeting room watching some Twitch streams of some people doing puzzles and enjoying themselves in there. There are a few other projects right now that are in developments
Publishing?
For the publishing arm. Yeah. And I just came back from Gamescom in Germany, where I was literally for 4 days sitting in a hotel lobby with people pitching me some projects, and I found a few really, really cool ones. So
that's
another thing that I'm spending a lot of my time on right now, is finding some great candidates that have awesome ideas of game we feel need to be made.
It's crazy to see how much of an effect a successful IP can have on a studio, right? All of this would not be possible if not for Dead by Daylight and all the work you did on it. So congrats to you, man.
Thank you.
Yeah, welcome. Yeah, you're welcome. Matsu Kote, thank you very much. You
that was fun.
Have accepted our invite. I hope we can do it again.
There you go.
Hey, have a nice one.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers.